Hello and welcome to this series of podcasts by Kilkenny Library Services in association with the Decade of Centenaries. My name is Owen Swinton Welch, and in these bite-sized podcasts I'll be mainly focusing on the many different facets of the War of Independence era in County Kilkenny. Now, in the first few episodes I'll be concentrating on the key events that were making the news in Kilkenny in 1920, just 100 short years ago. First up is the Huggenstown RIC barracks attack, which took place on Monday night, the 8th of March 1920. Indeed, I actually think this is a good place to start, as the attack at Huggenstown was one of the most well-known and remembered events of the era. It made news not just locally here in Kilkenny, but nationally around the country. Before we deep dive into what happened that night, I think it's important to set the context of what was happening in general in Ireland at the time. The first year of what is now considered the War of Independence, 1919, saw a small number of sporadic attacks and low levels of violence when compared to what would happen over the next year and a half. However, this all changed right at the very beginning of 1920. The main leaders of the Irish Republican Army in Ireland, namely Cathal Brua, Michael Collins, and Richard or Richard Mulcahy, believed it was necessary to step up the military aspect to be more offensive rather than defensive. They believed this was now necessary since the British government had made many organisations, including Dáil Éireann itself, illegal the previous September, that's September 1919. As the political wing of the movement, Sinn Féin, had won a general election in December 1918 on a policy of declaring a republic, they of course believed they had a legitimate political mandate to enforce this newly declared independence. Note, Sinn Féin in this period was a fairly catch-all movement, which of course at this time included the likes of Collins and De Valera, and represented many shades of nationalist republican opinion. It would of course split after the Civil War, with the vast majority of its leaders eventually joining what would become Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil. So why attack the RIC? Well, they were really the most obvious targets. Although the majority of the approximately 10,000 policemen that made up the force were Irish-born, they were responsible for enforcing the King's writ through the country. The force was a steady, pensionable job, something which is not easy to come by in early 20th century Ireland, as you can imagine. Although the RIC were by this stage a generally accepted part of life, they were also considered the eyes and ears of the Dublin Castle administration throughout rural Ireland. The RIC were also very vulnerable. There were more barracks throughout the countryside than would be the case today. These barracks were often located in remote, isolated areas, making easy targets, as was the case with Huggenstown, located in rural South Kilkenny. Furthermore, the average job of a policeman up to this point would have involved, for instance, fining people for not having sufficient lights on their bicycles, enumerating censuses returns, or collecting money for dog licences, which was a great source of local government income. Now, however, the police force were being faced with a military threat. For the likes of Michael Collins, the capture of RIC barracks had another extremely important benefit. They contained much sought-after arms, weapons and ammunition. So the RIC differed in this one significant aspect from the modern-day Garda Síochána in that they usually carried guns. It should also be noted that during this middle phase of the War of Independence, that is early 1920, there was no black and tans or auxiliaries in the country yet. They would not make their presence felt until the summer of 1920. Therefore, in rural Ireland, it was very much the IRA versus the RIC, and in many respects, the RIC were sitting ducks. Now, if you bear with me for a second, and this may seem slightly pedantic, but I want to differentiate between capturing an RIC barracks versus attacking one. During the early months of 1920, many RIC barracks were attacked, but only some were captured. Capturing a barracks involved the police inside surrendering. This was a major coup for the IRA, and not just in terms of the publicity it generated, but also in respect of the RIC having to give up their arms to their attackers. The Kilkenny IRA can therefore claim the first successful capture of a barracks in Leinster. The plans for the Huggenstown attack were initiated in January 1920 when the leader of the Kilkenny IRA, that's 34-year-old Tom Tracy, was summoned by IRA GHQ to Dublin. There he met Richard Mulcahy, the Chief of Staff, at St Enda's in Rathfarnham, which of course is where Patrick Pearse's boys' school was at the time, and it was still at the time ran by his sister and his mother. Tracy received instructions from Mulcahy that an RIC barracks was to be taken in Kilkenny. He didn't necessarily care which one, as long as one was taken. Initially, Tullerone RIC barracks was considered. Then advanced plans were drawn up for Coffs Grange RIC barracks, but these plans were thrown into disarray when people thought they were leaked to the authorities. It was then decided that the remote Huggenstown RIC barracks near the famed townland of Carrickshock would be the unlucky target. In preparation for the Huggenstown attack, Jimmy Lawler, who was the vice commander of the Kilkenny IRA, went to Huggenstown to meet with the leaders of the IRA there, who were Nicholas Carl and Willie Farrell, and they were quite supportive of the idea of attacking their local barracks. Also in preparation for the attack, Joe McMahon, who was an IRA organiser originally from County Clare, worked in the iron foundry of Peter de Lucre, who was at the time the Sinn Féin mayor of Kilkenny City. And there, McMahon created the casings for grenades to be used in the attacks. McMahon had been trained in explosives. The gelignite that was put into these grenades, or bombs as they were called by the IRA, had been sourced from the Castlecomber cone mines in North Kilkenny, where miners who were sympathetic to the cause had been smuggling it out. Gelignite was a very hard thing to come by in Ireland at this time, and Castlecomber coal mines or collieries were one of the only places in the country that had a licence to have it. In a fortunate turn of events for the Kilkenny men, Joe McMahon was lucky to escape capture just a week before the attack. Suspicious of his presence in Kilkenny, the RIC had arrested him in his bedroom, but while they waited for him to get dressed, he hopped out the window from the first floor and escaped. Now, when these grenades were completed, they were moved to O'Brien's of Viper in Kells before being transported by horse and cart to Huggenstown by Bob Cody of Vines Grove to the Magan. They were stored very close to the barracks in the yard of Joseph Halloran, hidden within a pile of mangolds, which were kind of like these beet vegetables used to feed animals back in the day before they were silage. Jimmy Lawler, the vice OC of the Kilkenny IRA Brigade, scouted the village of Huggenstown with the help of local IRA men. They noted that the gap between Cleary's pub and the RIC barracks would be perfect for a ladder to be positioned in. The night of Monday, the 8th of March 1920, was chosen as the date for the attack. Arrangements were made for telegraph wire cutting, which was carried out exceptionally well by the local IRA, as no other RIC barracks would come to their aid during the night. A motor car was also commandeered to transport combatants in the event of casualties, and Kilkenny Cumann na mBan leader, who was Hannah Murphy, was responsible for any first aid that was required, and she stayed nearby near Stonyford, ready for action if required. Luck would also play a part in the Huggenstown attack, as there was a relaxed atmosphere within the barracks. On the night in question, one of the RIC policemen, Constable Dockery, was having a retirement gathering in Cleary's pub next door, that night being his last on duty. Dockery's final night of service would turn out to be one of the most eventful of his 32-year career in the force. Ironically, his service officially ended at midnight on the 8th of March, right in the middle of the battle. Talk about bad timing. Around 35 men took part in the actual attack, with additional men acting as scouts and telegraph cable cutters, making it about 80 in total. Most were from the 1st Battalion area in Kilkenny City and the 7th Battalion area, then including Huggenstown. The 7th Kilkenny Battalion was based in Callan and was led at the time by Jim Roone. Other leaders who would become well known later in the War of Independence in Kilkenny were Captain Pat Welsh of the Namagan, fatally wounded the following year in Tullerone, and Ned Elward, who would eventually become leader of the West Kilkenny Flying Column, and both these men took part in the Huggenstown attack. Before the attack, all the men symbolically congregated in the nearby townland of Carrickshock, the site of a previous tight war altercation with Crown forces in 1831, and there's a lovely monument still there to this day. The IRA attacking party was then divided into four sections. Tom Tracy, who of course would be the overall leader, positioned himself with one section near the front of the barracks, behind a ditch. Another party was at the side, and another was at the rear. Finally, a party known as the Bombing Party, led by Joe McMahon of Clare, assembled in an adjoining yard near the back of the barracks, with the aim of attacking the roof. All six RIC men stationed in the barracks had returned from Cleary's pub by 10:30 p.m.
The attack commenced then at the planned time of 11:30 p.m. The commander, Tracy, using an improvised megaphone, as he said himself, informed the occupants they were under attack and would be given 10 minutes to surrender. They were also told that the women and children inside would be given safe passage away from the barracks. Sergeant John Nealon's wife and five children, ranging in the ages from 10 to 6 months, were living in the barracks at the time. Of course, was not unusual for the era, and which must have turned into a terrifying night for all the kids involved. I think now might be a good time to hear the account of the attack by some of the men who actually took part, and let them explain what happened in their own words. Firstly, the words of Jimmy Lawler, Jim Lawler, who, as I said, was the vice OC of the entire Kilkenny Brigade, and his accounts are actually available in the Bureau of Military History. He states as follows. With Tom Tracy and the Kilkenny contingent, I took up my position behind a low wall directly opposite to and about 25 yards from the front of the barracks. This party was armed principally with shotguns. The Cannon contingent, armed with shotguns and I think some rifles, under Leo Dardis, the brigade adjutant, occupied a position at the rear of the barracks. Men, whom we called the bombers, went onto the roof of a lean-to shed adjoining the barracks. On a signal from Tracy, the bombers on the roof dropped two grenades, one at the front and one at the rear of the barracks. Tracy, using an improvised megaphone, announced to the garrison that the barracks was about to be attacked and that he was giving them 3 minutes to surrender. No reply was received, and when the 3 minutes were up, Tracy then gave the signal for the general attack to begin. End quote. Another account comes from Jim Lahey. Jim Lahey, of course, was the overall commander of the 7th Battalion, which was headquartered in Callan, and he later recalled, "My position in this attack was with a party of 8 or 9 men, all armed with shotguns, who occupied a haggard at the end of the barracks. From here, we controlled the road, which ran in front of the barracks, and their instructions were to fire on the policemen if they made a sortie out of the barracks," end quote. Actually, it might be of benefit to note at this point that in their accounts of the War of Independence, the men were required to emphasise what kind of weapons they had available to them in 1920 and 1921. The vast majority only had shotguns, which were widely accessible, but not very useful, especially in a long-range attack. There was some police-type revolvers also available. The rifle, usually the Lee Enfield, was the much sought after firearm. We are lucky to have a record available from one of the bombing party who was present in Huggenstown that night. Martin Cassidy was the captain of one of the Kilkenny Sissy companies. Cassidy and four companions were very much on the front line of this attack, and the successful capture of Huggenstown barracks depended greatly on these five men. And here are some of Cassidy's testimonies from the night. The bombing party consisted of Joe McMahon, Tom Murphy, Billy Oakes, Michael Phelan and myself. Joe McMahon was in charge of this small section, and all five of us, having assisted in making the bombs, were familiar with the handling of them. The bombing party was armed with revolvers and in addition carried slating hammers for the purpose of breaking through the slates on the roof if necessary. We also had a fairly good-sized homemade bomb or mine made from the box of a cartwheel packed with gelignite. The intention was that if the police in the barracks did not surrender to the gunfire, we, that is the bombing party, would break the roof and through the breach pour in the grenades and inflammable material and for good measure the bomb or mine, set the place on fire and thus force their surrender. When final instructions were given, we moved into our positions as quietly as we could. We, that is the bombing section, had no difficulty in entering Cleary's yard, the gateway of which had been opened for us. A long ladder, which was left there earlier in the evening by arrangement with the local Huggenstown Volunteer Company, was lying in the yard. Joe McMahon and I hoisted a ladder against the gable end of the wall. This gave us access to a lean-to roof from which we had access to the main roof. McMahon and I then climbed the ladder. After an exchange of signals between the Brigade OC Tracy and McMahon that everything was in order, McMahon flung some of the bombs onto the ground at both the front and rear of the barracks. The Brigade OC then called on the police to surrender and gave them some minutes to evacuate any women or children who might be in the barracks. The reply he received was volleys of fire from the barracks. He, that is the Brigade OC Tracy, then gave the signal for the general attack to begin. Our parties at the front and rear of the barracks then opened fire, which they concentrated on the windows and doors of the barracks. This fire was vigorously replied to by the policemen inside. From time to time, Joe McMahon, from his position on top of the ladder, fired some more of the bombs, which exploded with deafening noise right beside the barracks wall. The RAC men also used grenades, which they flung out through the top windows of the barracks. I should perhaps mention that the bottom windows of the barracks were shuttered with steel shutters. Once, when coming down the ladder to get more bombs for McMahon, I was fired at point-blank range, through a loophole in the gable end of the barracks wall facing Cleary's Yards. The bullets just whizzed past my head. I shouted at McMahon that the police were firing through this loophole, which up to this we had more or less ignored. McMahon's answer to me was, "You just let them have the contents of your yoke," meaning, of course, my revolver, "through the loopholes." I then fired the 6 rounds of my Wembley revolver straight in through the loophole, and we had no further trouble from that quarter. The attack continued for about half an hour, after which time McMahon and I, who were both still on the ladder, could hear cries of pain and moans coming from inside the barracks. At the same time, we heard the RAC men shouting, "We surrender." The firing then ceased, and McMahon, in a loud voice, shouted to the police to bring out their arms and to lay them down on the road at a point opposite the barracks. After a few minutes, the barrack door opened, and one policeman came out carrying 6 rifles, which he laid down on the road. The Brigade OC Tracy sent them back into the barracks for some small arms. The policeman then brought out 3 or 4 revolvers, which he put down on the road beside the rifles. Meanwhile, some of our men entered the barracks and carried out 3 large wooden boxes of .303 rifle ammunition. And that ends Cassidy's account there. So what actually happened inside the barracks? A constable named Thomas Ryan lay severely wounded. His right upper arm and elbow had been shattered from blast, and he was bleeding profusely. Constable Ryan was actually considered an expert bomber, and during the attack went upstairs and started dropping grenades through a small opening in the gable end of the barracks. This opening had only been constructed the previous month with the express purpose of dropping grenades during an attack of this nature. After about 15 minutes, Ryan had come down the stairs and said, "I am killed. They got me through the window," and subsequently became unconscious. RIC Sergeant Nealon informed Tracy that one of his men was injured and he needed a priest and a doctor, which were sent for immediately. Dr. James Marnell of Kilmaganny arrived at the barracks but was unable to help 39-year-old Constable Thomas Ryan, who died at about 6 a.m. just a few hours after the attack started. Ryan was originally from Limerick, so he's a Limerick man, but he had been living in Ballybricken in Waterford City and left a wife and 5 children. The captured weapons and ammunition were brought by horse and cart to Enniskanagh near Stonyford for safe keeping and later distributed. Jim Lahey's Callan contingent did manage to pinch one of the rifles for themselves, as they put it, which was used during the Drangan barracks attacks in Tipperary just 3 months later. Jim Lawler stated that after the Hugginson attacked, his group, which he called the Kilkenny Party, cycled back to Kilkenny City via Kells without incident and reached our homes about 4 a.m, as he put it, rising for work just 3 hours later. So, after those dramatic events of the 8th of March 1920, I think now is probably a good time to finish this podcast. In the next episode, I will look at the aftermath of the Hugginson attack. This will include the RIC policemen's version of what occurred, the mass arrests of some of those involved, the reaction of the Catholic Church, the subsequent compensation hearing of the deceased Thomas Ryan's widow, the destruction of the Hugginson barracks itself and other barracks around the county, and the hunger strike and subsequent homecoming of the Hugginstown prisoners. So, lots more to come. I hope you will join me again. Goodbye.